Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Listening to another episode of Lords of Limited with your hosts Ben Wernie and Ethan Sachs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Wernie, and joining me on the line is Ethan Sachs. Ethan, how was your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was great, man. It's my first time taking the reins of the old turkey and hosting. I had my parents and in-laws and brother-in-law over, and it was great. Only like one minor kitchen freakout, and it wasn't even mine, so I'd call the dinner a success.
What a grown-up.
What a grown-up, yeah. Well, you know, doing all things grown-up in my life, playing lots of magic and cooking turkeys. How about you? You had a really exciting weekend.
Oh, my Lord, yeah. We went to Philadelphia and New York with the band over Thanksgiving break, so we hopped on two coach buses on Tuesday after school, drove all night to Philadelphia, and toured Philadelphia during the day. And then on Thursday, we marched in the Philadelphia Dunkin' Donuts Thanksgiving Day Parade, which was really awesome. Super cool. And then we drove on over to New York, and we did some sightseeing in New York for a few days. So we saw like the Statue of Liberty, we went on top of the Rockefeller Center, like all the touristy type things. And we did a bunch of other sweet stuff too. My highlight of the trip was probably seeing Wicked. It was so good.
That's awesome. I think someone who I went to school with is playing Glinda in that right now.
Oh man, they were, if it's your friend, the people that played Glinda and Elphaba were phenomenal. They were so good.
Not surprised. Was that your first time in New York?
It was my first time in New York. Yeah, I was. You lived there, didn't you?
I did. Yeah,
I was overwhelming. Like at first when we got there, I was thinking there's zero chance I could ever live like somewhere that big. And then like after seeing Wicked, I really started to think like, you know, I have a master's degree in clarinet performance, and I used to play a lot more than I do now. Like every once in a while I sub with an orchestra or something, but I think if I like was playing in a pit orchestra as part of a show like that, or like had a regular like thing playing clarinet, I think I could live in a city like that and do something like that. I think it would be pretty awesome.
And the thing is, like, most people are not living in Midtown, like in like the Times Square area. Like, you know, I lived about a 45-minute train ride away from there. So, you know, it's a big place to live, and most of the places that are not that are really, really nice. There's like tons of really wonderful neighborhoods.
It was just incredible. It was so huge.
And wait, most importantly, how was the Shake Shack burger?
Oh yeah, I texted you for recommendations, and you were like, you got to try the Shake Shack burger. It was good. It was right up my alley. It was awesome. Yeah. Milkshake, cheese fries, double cheeseburger. It was great.
Great. I'm so happy. Did you have any time for any drafts?
I did. I made myself even more tired during the trip because I felt like I needed to have something to contribute to the podcast. So I jammed an IMA draft a couple of the nights, and I Skyped in with my brothers for Friday after Thanksgiving. We Skyped and did an Ixalan draft together over Skype, which was super fun.
Oh, cool. So what's your trophy update?
Yeah, I'm at still at 3 trophies. I've cooled down in IMA. Still at 3 trophies. I've done 8 drafts. I've done 5 more drafts, and my overall record now is 18-6. So I have a 75% win rate. So I 2-1 5 times, and I 1-2'd once.
What a scrub. He doesn't have an undefeated record anymore.
I know.
Oh my God.
How about you? What's going on with you?
I have 5 trophies. I had a little airport heater while I was waiting for my flight from Las Vegas back to Pittsburgh. So I'm up to 30 drafts now, 59-31, 66% win rate. Mostly hanging out in 2-1's purgatory, which is not the best, but at least it's not 1-2 purgatory.
But you crushed some big names during your airport drafts, right?
I did crush some big names. So I texted you that I was going to do, for the first time ever, a sky draft. Because I was like, you know, this flight, it was paid for me to go to Vegas for this rehearsal. And I was like, I'll splurge for the $8 for the Wi-Fi and try and do a draft. Everyone always talks about sky drafting. Sounds so fun. And I ended up playing Kenji on his impromptu 24-hour stream when he cracked 1,000 subs. And played him from, you know, however many thousands of feet above. And 2-0'd him, you know, just like an
NFL.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that was a good feeling, especially after my internet scrubbed me out of the streamer showdown the day before. So that was a bummer.
Yeah.
So as our faithful listeners will know, we started a Patreon a few weeks ago, which is a very exciting way for listeners to give back to the show for some cool perks and a way to support the show monetarily if you so desire. The show will always be free, but it's a nice little boost for us and a way for us to give back to you even more in terms of some bonuses. So we have some new patrons to shout out this week. So we wanted to thank Joey, Adam, Sally, and Nick for all joining the Lords of Limited Patreon. We really, really appreciate your support. We'll be getting out to you copies of show notes, access to the Discord channel, and even a little behind-the-scenes audio preview for those of you who are at that Warrior of Limited status. So we really, really appreciate your support. It means so, so much to us.
Yeah, it's really cool. Really, really cool.
And another pretty exciting thing happened just this afternoon, Ben.
Oh my God, that was awesome. I opened my phone on the so I was on the tour bus, the coach bus, when I read this tweet, and I opened my phone and I was like, yes, out loud. And the kids were all like, wait, what? What happened?
That's great.
Generation D20 crossed off our last achievement for the XLN treasure hunt. So he did the Sanguine Sacrament infinite loop.
Yeah, those screenshots were amazing. I was like, wait, what happened? It's like his hand is full of 7 cards. He's at 14 life, and then the next screenshot, he's at 48 life. I was like, oh, I see what you did. So 18-hour stream confirmed. Ben and I will be doing the full 18 hours because of all of you unlocking various treasures and throughout this hunt, and we'll set that up sometime over the holiday season for Vintage Cube being out. I think that's going to be super sweet.
Yeah, I am looking forward to it.
It's going to be great. But for now, we are still in the 3 weeks of Iconic Masters Bliss, and I would love to invite you to take a seat at the round table to check out a draft with me, Ben.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so the cards in consideration out of our first pack here are Draconic Roar, 1 in a red for an instant. As an additional cost to cast it, you can reveal a dragon card from your hand, and it deals 3 damage to a creature. And if you have a dragon in play, or if you reveal the dragon, it also deals 3 damage to that creature's controller. Topin Freeblade, perhaps not seeing the glory that it once did when it was reigning common champ in Magic Origins, but that's 1 and a white for a 2/2 human soldier with vigilance, and it has renown 1, so when it deals damage to a creature, if it's not renowned, it gets a +1/+1 counter on it and becomes renowned.
Damage to a player, right?
Damage to a player, thank you. Yes, I meant to specify that if I didn't. 2 of the bounce lands from Ravnica. We have the green-blue and the blue-black, Simic Growth Chamber and Dimir Aqueduct. And a big boy, Kakusho the Evening Star. That's 4 black-black for the 5/5 legendary dragon spirit creature. It has flying, and when it dies, each opponent loses 5 life, and you gain life equal to the life lost this way.
Yeah, I mean, those are all solid options. I would pretty immediately rule out Draconic Roar and Topin Freeblade. Topin Freeblade, I think, is the worst of the cards you named. It's underperformed pretty drastically, I think, because even when it gets renowned, it's only got 3 toughness, or 3 power, I mean, rather. And that's still not enough to punch through walls like Doorkeeper and Vent Sentinel, which I think are a pretty important part of the format.
Yeah, or Wall of Roots or Overgrown Battlement. I mean, like...
Yeah, there's just so many walls running around.
Mm-hmm.
And Draconic Roar, for the same reason, only does 3 damage, and a lot of those walls have 4 and or 5 toughness. So while it's a good, efficient removal spell, I think it's a little less good in this format than it would be in a different format.
Yeah, for sure.
Bounce lands, obviously great, but I think Kakusho takes the cake here and is the pick.
I think so too. I was trying to think if there was any uncommon, like, would you take Fireball over Kakusho?
I would take Swords to Plowshares over Kakusho.
Interesting.
I think it's a big flyer with a great ability, but I think there's enough big flyers that it's fairly replaceable. I mean, it's an above average finisher.
Yeah.
But I think Swords to Plowshares is pretty unique in the format and super, super good.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's the one that comes to mind first. I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure there are other uncommons. I would take over it too, actually.
But you would be on it here over the bounce lands.
I think so. Yeah.
Great. That is what I settled on as well. So move on to pack one, pick two. Cards in consideration. I think surprisingly, we're going to include Survival Cache here. That's two and a white for the sorcery. You gain two life. Then if you have more life than an opponent, you draw a card and it has rebound. So you exile it upon its resolution the first time it's cast, and then you get to cast it again on your upkeep for no mana cost to you. We've got a Mind Stone, two colorless mana for an artifact that taps for a generic mana. You can also pay one and tap it to sacrifice it to draw a card. Another Draconic Roar. We have a Doorkeeper, card we'll be talking about a lot today. One and a blue for an 0/4 Homunculus Defender, and has two and a blue tap. Target player mills X cards from the top of their library, where X is the number of defenders you control. Crown Ceratoc, 3 and a green for the 4/3 Trample Rhino that has each creature you control with a +1/+1 counter on it has trample. So sort of a mini payoff for the counter synergies decks. And Monastery Swift Spear, 1 red for a 1/2 haste with prowess. And Azorius Charm, white-blue for an instant. You choose one of three things. Creatures you control gain lifelink until end of turn, draw a card, or put target attacking or blocking creature on top of its owner's library.
Yeah, so there's a lot of similarly powered cards here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so happy you included Survival and Cash. The card's my boy.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's the pick here. They go fairly late. And I think there's a certain number of them you want. So certainly don't need to pick it this highly, I don't think. Mindstone's great. But I've not been finding myself taking the Mana Rocks quite as highly as I would in Cube or things like that. I think they're a little less good in this format.
Yeah.
Draconic Roar, same reasons we mentioned earlier. So that kind of reins it down. A Doorkeeper, Ceratox, Swift Spear, and Azorius Charm. And those all go in very different decks. Like the Swift Spear wants to be in an aggro tempo deck. The Ceratox wants to be in a +1/+1 counter deck. And Azorius Charm, while maybe the most... That's not even the most powerful card here. I just think Doorkeeper is the best card. It's so flexible, and it goes very well with Kokoshu. And it lets you pivot off of that into any other deck. It's just the best and most flexible card in the pack, I think.
Yeah, super flexible. I think it's important to note, and I think this influenced my decision, I took Doorkeeper as well, is that there is a Jace's Phantasm and a Shriekgeist in the first pack, and those are two of the commons that we'll be talking about later today that I think are worth tracking for the blue-black mill deck. So I was taking Doorkeeper as well as for what you said, that it's a super powerful card in the pack, but also that paired with Kokoshu is going to lead me down a blue-black route, and what blue-black wants to do is mill and have cards that have mill payoffs, and the commons like Jace's Phantasm and Shriekgeist, I think, fit that bill very nicely, and you really want to track them when you open them and see if they come around, because there's not a lot of wiggle room in terms of how many people can be vying for those cards. So I snapped up the Doorkeeper here as well. Move on to pack one, pick three. Cards in consideration are Seeker of the Way, 1 white for the 2/2 human warrior with prowess, and whenever you cast a non-creature spell, it gains lifelink until end of turn. Still sort of the bread and butter of both aggro decks with white in them and life gain matters decks. We've also got another Crown Ceratoc, that's the green trampler. Blinding Mage, 1 and a white for the 1/2 that can tap a creature for a single white mana. Amass the Components, 3 and a blue for a sorcery, draw 3, then put a card from your hand on the bottom of your library. And I think that's probably it. Any other cards from this pack you think worth mentioning?
No, I think that covers it. The three that stand out to me are Seeker of the Way, Blinding Mage, and Amass the Components.
Mm-hmm.
Deciding between Blinding Mage and Seeker of the Way, I tend to pick Seeker of the Way higher than Blinding Mage. It's pretty close here. Blinding Mage probably goes better in a deck with Kokoshu because it's more defensive and you're going to want to get to the late game in a deck like that. But I think for me, Amass edges out both of those white cards. It goes along with the Doorkeeper very well that you already picked, and has just been a card that's impressed me a ton in the format. If you get to the point in the game where you've got enough mana to be casting an Amass without much pressure on you, it's probably going to win you the game.
Someone in my Twitch chat, maybe a little less than a week ago, was telling me about was trying to hammer home the importance of bounce lands to me. And one of the things that they highlighted was how good Amass the Components and Tormenting Voice become with bounce lands.
Yeah, because you get to pitch excess lands.
Yeah, like you get to pitch a land with Amass, you get to like pitch a land that you don't need because you've played a bounce land with Tormenting Voice. I already sort of knew how powerful Amass the Components was, but now I really look at Tormenting Voice in a much different light when you've got bounce lands as well. But so I really agree with you that it's such a super powerful card. So that's what you'd be on right here.
I think so, yeah.
I grabbed Blinding Mage. I think I was trying to, like, maybe keep still in sort of, like, pick three mode, trying to keep my options the most open, because I think amass the components plus doorkeeper is very good. But if I'm just looking at like pack one, pick one out of this pack, I think Blinding Mage sort of leads me down various paths effectively. I've been less impressed with Seeker of the Way than I thought I would be, just because I don't think white has a terribly aggressive bent. I've not been super crazy about the white-red or white-blue aggro decks, and so I basically think that Seeker of the Way really slots into the life gain deck nicely, but I didn't want to pigeonhole myself there. So I just grabbed Blinding Mage and sort of thought, oh, that could go with the Doorkeeper, that could go with the Kakusho, maybe I just go full Esper, who knows.
Oh, that's interesting. I've been super impressed with Seeker of the Way. Like, I've had the complete opposite experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that's one of the cards that makes, like, white-red and white-blue aggro playable. Because that plus the Guided Strike is so good. It lets you punch through the walls.
I just think white-red is so bad.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it's great, but I think Seeker of the Way is good in that. I don't know. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, yeah, it can be. It's good in the white-red deck, I guess, but the white-red deck is bad, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree. It's not a great deck. No, certainly not a tier one deck.
So you would grab a Mass. I grabbed Blinding Mage. We'll move on to pack one, pick four. We've got a Star Compass, two colorless for an artifact. Enters the battlefield tapped, and it can tap to add one mana of any color that a basic land you control could produce. Repeal, X and a blue for an instant. Return target non-land permanent with converted mana cost X and to its owner's hand, and you draw a card. Reeve Soul, one and a black for sorcery, destroy target creature with power three or less. Evolving Wilds, that's the land that taps to sacrifice and find a basic land from your deck, put it into play tapped, and then you shuffle your library. Another Blinding Mage, another Amass the Components, a Windfall, which is two and a blue for each player discards his or her hand, then draws cards equal to the greatest number of cards a player discarded this way, and a blue-black Bounce Land, Dimir Aqueduct.
Yeah, so there's several cards that are, like, very good here.
Yeah, there's a lot of powerful options here.
I think the most powerful of them are Reeve Soul, Amass, Windfall, and Dimir Aqueduct. I'm currently on a Windfall kick, so I would be really tempted to take Windfall here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's super powerful, and I think it's abusable in the format. Like, just with a really good blue-red aggro deck.
Yeah.
I think that deck really wants Windfall. You were telling me earlier today that you saw LSV play against, like, a Windfall Suspend deck.
Suspend deck. It was crazy. But, like, I hadn't even considered that as a possible interaction. That, like, oh, that's how you get cards out of your hand. Just, like, suspend, pitch the other cards, like, draw two. So good.
Yeah, I do think Windfall's abusable in the format, but it's like, pretty hit or miss.
Do you need to take it this highly?
No, I don't think so. But I would be tempted to. But I think the clear standout is Dimir Aqueduct to me. The Karu lands are great. You've already got a black card. You know you want to play it. You've got a blue card that you could splash in Doorkeeper if you really wanted to. And splashing Amass the Components is great in the format, I think.
Yeah.
It's super splashable and super powerful. So Dimir Aqueduct just opens up so many options and only takes up a land slot in your deck. So I think that's probably the correct pick there.
Yeah. I also grabbed the Aqueduct there, but I was pretty tempted by a number of other options and sort of bummed to take that and then pass, like, good white, black, and blue cards out of this pack. That felt bad for sure, but what can you do? So the rest of the draft was pretty interesting. I mean, we took a Sarah Angel next, a Bounce Land after that, some blue counters, or some black counters cards, and then noticed that the mill cards out of the first pack didn't wheel, so that sort of clued me into blue probably not panning out, and sort of, like, went on a best card out of each pack kick, opened up a pretty unexciting pack two, and grabbed a Scourge of Valkis, which is a big, like, near mono red dragon payoff card. It's a 4/4 flyer that when it enters the battlefield deals X damage to target creature or player, where X is the number of dragons you control. So pretty bad pick for us with our, like, random Esper smatterings.
But the pack was just blank, right? There was nothing.
The pack was
else
pretty
good.
Blank, and Kakusho's a dragon, so who knows? Maybe we pivot into red black. Like, I didn't feel sort of married to anything after pack one. And then got past Vorinclex, which is the green mythic praetor, the 7/6 trampler that doubles the mana that you produce and has your opponent's land stay tapped for a turn when they use them. And then ended up actually picking up on a pretty strong green signal, like taking that Vorinclex second led to a bunch of other green cards that pack, and ended up with a pretty decent black-green Counters Matters deck with a Corpse Jack Menace and things like that. So, you know, not necessarily where I thought we were going to end up from the first five picks, but that's how the draft crumbled.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the great things about this format that's refreshing after playing Ixalan. Like, Ixalan is, like, pretty much two-color pair, or like multicolored dirtle deck like we talked about. Uh-huh. And here you're free to pivot and bob and weave between the two color decks because there's so much, like, you don't have to lock in early on a two color deck because there's so much overlap and synergy between the various color pairs.
And different things, you can be like, oh, I'm blue-red, so I'm blue-red walls. No, I'm blue-red spells. Or, oh, I'm white-black counters. No, I'm white-black life gain. Like, you can, there's many different things that color pairs are doing in this format where, like you said, like in Ixalan, it's like, no, you're white-black, you're vampires. And if you're not, you're probably doing it wrong.
Yep.
So what do we got on tap for today, Ben?
We have a pretty sweet episode. We're going to talk about the top 8 edges that you can gain in IMA draft based on what we've learned so far from jamming our almost 40 drafts between the two of us, which is the lion's share. You did. But yes. Hey, since I'm on Team Lords of Limited, I'm going to take some credit for our team.
But you have almost the half of the trophies we have. So I think you're nothing to sneeze at with your 3 trophies and 8 draft record.
Yeah, so we're gonna take you through just 8 thoughts here that can really help you gain an edge in your next draft. And we're gonna count down from 8 to 1. So I'm gonna go ahead and take us through our first one here. Number 8, we've got watch out for onboard tricks and ways to punt because of unfamiliar cards. So there's a lot of tricky cards in this set. Have you made any mistakes yet?
You know, I'm sure I have, but most of my issues have been with either my internet dying in Las Vegas or in an airplane. So I'm not sure, but I think I probably have. Have you?
Oh yeah. Most of this list is stuff I've done already.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I still have a high win rate, so yeah. not getting punished.
These are lunches, not punts.
Lunches. Yes. And so for anybody that doesn't watch, our streams, lunches is like a mini mistake. Like, doesn't necessarily cost you a game, but certainly not playing optimally.
It's like missing a ping with a wall of Forgotten Pharaohs is like, that's a lunch. Like, it's not going to cost you the game. It's just like a mistake you shouldn't make.
Which originated because I was Skyping into your stream and you asked me a question and I had my mouth stuffed full of turkey sandwich and I was like, say what? You talking to me?
And your phrase is so perfect, I think I'll remember it forever. You were like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm eating lunch too much.
So, that was great.
So amazing.
And thus the lunch was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, so some cards to watch out here for, and I think once these happen to you once, like, you will never make the mistake again, but Benevolent Ancestor, that's 2W for the 0/4 defender that can tap to prevent a damage to target creature or player. So if you've got stuff that's matched up evenly and they've got a Benevolent Ancestor on their side of the battlefield, it will not trade because they can prevent 1 damage to the stuff on their side of the battlefield. And also of note, Benevolent Ancestor can block things that are attacking it with 4 power, so it can block and prevent a damage to itself. So make sure you don't miss out on that one. And it's unusual to have, I think, this many cards in a set, like if you're fairly new to drafting, that are onboard tricks. Like, I think Wizards just try to move away from that because it just creates feel-bad situations.
Especially onboard tricks that are free. Like, I mean,
right, that don't have a mana activation.
Exactly. We'll see a few more on this list that are all just requiring the creature itself to tap rather than pay any sort of mana.
Second one on the list here is a Johnny's Pride Mate and life gain. So a Johnny's Pride Mate is the 1W for the 2/2 that whenever you gain a life, you could put a +1/+1 counter on it. So you need to watch out if your opponent's got instant speedways that are on the battlefield to gain life. For example, maybe they've got a Bubbling Cauldron sitting on their side of the battlefield and they can sacrifice a creature to gain 4 life with their Bubbling Cauldron. Next one on the list, Angelic Accord. I've definitely messed this one up. That's the 3W enchantment that says at the beginning of your end step, if you've gained 4 life, you get to create a 4/4 flying angel token. So I had 2 of these in play and I waited until my opponent's end step to sacrifice my creature with Bubbling Cauldron to gain 4 life. And I was planning on getting 2 4/4 flying angels and I did not get 2 4/4 flying angels. But luckily that combo was busted enough that I was able to recover from my mistake. So if you have Angelic Accord and you're doing that nonsense, make sure you remember to trigger in your second main phase or your opponent's second main phase. Another one, don't forget about rebound spells coming back or cards coming off of suspend. So those are going to be in the exile zone. So make sure you pop open if you're playing on Magic Online, your opponent's exile zone, and try to remember to track when you're doing like combat math and racing situations or things like that, that you factor all that stuff in. It's a lot of information to track that's not like right in front of you on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Next up is Prodigal Pyromancer. That's 2W for the 1/1. These cards are known as Tims from way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know why they're called Tims? I don't know that.
It's because of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. There's like a wizard that they meet, and I think they maybe ask him his name or whatever, and he goes, "There are those who call me Tim."
That's the line. Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that. All right. Yeah. So anyway, they can tap to deal one damage to target creature or player. No mana cost. So it has a ping there. Assault Formation. That's the green build around enchantment. Lets all your cards deal damage equal to their toughness, and you can pay a single green and have target creature with defender attack this turn as though it didn't have defender, and you can pay two and a green to give all of your creatures +0/+1 until end of turn.
There's two things to remember about this card. One is that +0/+1 thing, I feel like you get stuck in this mindset of like walls being the things that this card messes with, but it's all your creatures. So that Assault Formation pump, the +0/+1, is essentially +1/+1, and it's for your entire team.
Yes, that was what I messed up.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it only affects combat damage. So if you've got a Hunt the Weak, don't cast Hunt the Weak and have your Wall of Roots fight your opponent's creature. That is not going to end well for you when you've got Assault Formation in play.
A lot to keep track of there. Blinding Mage, just we haven't seen a lot of really good cheap tappers lately. So that's the 1/1/2 single white tapper. They can double tap, like on your end step, they can tap down one of your creatures, and then on their turn, they can tap another creature to tap down two of your blockers. So make sure you're taking that into account, again, in racing situations. And the last one is Infantry Veteran. That one's, I think, for whatever reason, like easier to keep track of than Benevolent Ancestor, but similar, mm-hmm. that you can tap it to give target attacking creature +1/+1. So all those things have some tricky activated abilities that you need to make sure you're taking into account when you're playing games of Iconic Masters.
There's a lot going on. Like, I mean, this, you know, especially with all the rarity downshifting that we're seeing in these Masters sets, that you see much more complex cards at common. So it's a lot to keep track of. I can't imagine playing this set in paper. That would be a lot more remembering of triggers and things. You don't just get to pop out your opponent's exile zone, you know?
Yeah. What do we got going on in number 7 here?
All right. Number 7 is keeping track of the blue-black aggro mill deck. I think this is one of the best decks in the format, but I believe it can only support one drafter. So as we talked about in the roundtable, you really want to be tracking the commons for this deck in your first few picks in pack one and seeing if they wheel. And so I'm always keeping in mind, as you saw in the roundtable, like when Shriekgeist and Jace's Phantasm, so Shriekgeist is the one, a blue 1/1 flyer that mills two when it hits your opponent. Jace's Phantasm is the 1/1 flyer for one blue that is a 5/5 if your opponent has 10 or more cards in their graveyard. There's White of Precinct 6, which is one and a black for the 1/1 that gets +1/+1 for each creature card in your opponent's graveyard. And then there's Thought Scour, which is the single blue instant draw card and mill 2 on a player. So you can target yourself or target your opponent, but in this deck you would always be targeting your opponent. So these cards at common, I think, are really the engines and slash payoffs of the deck, like Shriekgeist and Thought Scour being consistent engines for getting cards in your opponent's graveyard, and White of Precinct 6 and Jace's Phantasm as the most common ways to reap the benefits of your opponent having lots of cards in their graveyard. I think that there's maybe a tendency, I sort of think about this like we thought of, maybe some people thought of Slitherblade in Amonkhet drafts. Like,
oh yeah, that's a good analogy.
When you see Slitherblade like fifth, like you would keep track of them as you saw them. And then if you saw it like fifth or sixth in pack one, you'd be like, all right, this seems like if I take it here as maybe a hedge, and if they wheel in pack one, then I just get these two or these three, and I sort of stake my claim as the Slitherblade drafter, and I'm going to get all the rest of them that are opened in packs two and pack three. Because by that point, people are sort of off of it. And I think that's a similar way to think about this. Like, you track that you saw some of these cards in your first few picks. Around pick six, you see another one. You grab it then, and then if it wheels, great. And if it doesn't, you're off it, because you cannot compete with someone for this deck. There's, of course, a lot of good payoffs at uncommon and rare, for sure, like Glimpse the Unthinkable, the blue-black rare that mills 10. Those are I think, reasons to like try and force this deck. But if you're just trying to get at it from the common level of cards, I think that's the way to approach this deck. So it's just another extra thing that you have to track in the draft, but I think it's going to really lead to a powerful deck if you are able to find that to be what your seat is supposed to draft.
Yeah, and I don't think the deck needs the uncommons or the rares to be good. I think if you're the only one doing this deck and you get all the commons, your deck's going
to
be great.
You also need to think about, like, so it's not just milling, it's cards in the graveyard, period. So think about how your cards are affecting your opponent's cards, and things like Claustrophobia go way down in value. I think you should just never play Claustrophobia in this deck, because it's never going to help you get cards in your opponent's graveyard. Whereas I think counter spells go way up because that's at least going to one for one. Sort of like removal, get a thing in the graveyard.
Or the, like the Wrench Mind card that makes them discard too.
Right, so like discard is also totally fine if you're trying to do that. Or the Haunting Him, that's the 6-mana one that can discard 4 or discard 2 if you cast it as an instant. So yeah, that's a way to track that deck and also reevaluate cards as you find yourself narrowing in on that deck for your seat.
That Silver Blade analogy was great. That's not in our show notes, and I feel like I was struggling with how to draft this deck, and I feel like I know how to draft it now with just that analogy. That was great.
Excellent.
That was awesome. I love it.
Great.
I do think Jace's Phantasm, you can pick maybe a little higher than the other cards. Mm-hmm. I think Jace's Phantasm also is a fine finisher in a blue control deck because just over the course of the game, like you're going to end up with your cards in your opponent's graveyard, and then mm-hmm. your Jace's Phantasm becomes a 5/5. And I think it's also the linchpin for the blue-black deck, like one of the biggest payoffs.
Yeah.
So if you can maybe cut those a little bit more than the other cards and then see if the other cards wheel.
It's also a fine sideboard card, I think. I've had a few drafts where I've like tried to get into this deck and found it not perhaps what my seat was supposed to do, but I've had two in the sideboard. And if you play against a controlling blue deck that's like running Amass the Components or like a lot of repeal or card draw stuff, that's so they're voluntarily putting stuff in their graveyard or churning through their deck at a fast rate, because these formats do end up in sort of grindy control matchups a lot of the time. And Jace's Phantasm is a real easy way to break through that. You're just like, oh, look at this random 1-mana 5/5 I drew on turn 10 because you've drawn so many cards or whatever. It's a very versatile, powerful card, I think.
Yeah. So at number 6 on our list here, we've got that build arounds are very real in this set, very good, and should be picked accordingly highly. I think I've not seen a build around yet that doesn't work and isn't good if you get the payoffs for it and get your deck built around it to take advantage of it.
For sure.
So in the blue-black mill deck, we've got Glimpse the Unthinkable that we just mentioned, and we've got Blizzard Spectre at Uncommon as the build around there. That's 2 blue-black for the 2/3 flyer that when it hits your opponent, you can return a permanent to their hand or make them discard a card. Mm-hmm. So when it does damage to them, you can make them fill up their graveyard by making them discard. And then kind of like my certainly pet deck in the format, and I think you're getting on board as well, the Defender deck. So we've got some Defender build arounds here. Doorkeeper, that's 1 and a blue for the 0/4. So you can pay 2 and a blue and mill equal to the number of defenders you have. Event Sentinel, 3 and a red for the 2/4 defender. And you can pay 1 and a red and tap to deal damage equal to the number of defenders you control. Assault Formation, we just mentioned in our board punting section of the countdown here. That's the enchantment that lets your stuff deal damage equal to their toughness. And Overgrown Battlements is, what, 3 and a green?
No, just 1 and a green.
1 and a green? Oh my god, that card's busted.
Yeah.
One and a green for an 0/4 that taps equal to the number of defenders you control. So that's kind of the payoff in the blue-green defender deck there that wants to ramp. All of these and various flavors of defenders. There's defenders in every color except black.
Mm-hmm.
So very flexible archetype there, very different iterations of the defender deck. Next on these build arounds, we've got the kind of the +1/+1 counter grouping. That's Korpchak Menace, 2 black green for the 4/4 that doubles +1/+1 counters put onto your creatures. Abzan Falconer, 2 and a white for the 2/3 with Outlast, 1 white that you can tap to put a +1/+1 counter on it. And then all things you have with +1/+1 counters gain flying. That's a great way to finish the games in these +1/+1 counter decks. Because mm-hmm. I found a lot of times that deck has trouble punching through if the ground gets clogged up. And then Abzan Battle Priest, similarly, another Outlast creature, 3 and a white for the 3/2 with Outlast of a single white. And then gives all your creatures with +1/+1 counters on them lifelink. Next category here, we've kind of got like some blue-red groupings, Skywise Teachings, although I think this also goes in like pretty much every deck with instants and sorceries, not restricted to blue-red. It's 3 and a blue for the enchantment that lets you, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, pay 1 and a blue to make a 2/2 flying drake, I believe. And then Kiln Fiend, 1 and a red for the 1/2 that gets +3/+0 whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell. And Gutter Snipe, 2 and a red for the 2/2 that lets you deal 2 damage to your opponent whenever you cast an instant or a sorcery spell. Those are all kind of in the spells matter archetype there and are reasons to draft that blue-red deck.
Next up, we've got one that I think sort of tracks with the blue-black strategy as well, just in terms of how you want to keep track of the cards. So we've got the Bog Brew Witch, Bubbling Cauldron, Festering Newt triple combo. So Bog Brew Witch is 3 and a black for a 1/3, and you can pay 2 mana and tap it to search your library for a card named Bubbling Cauldron or Festering Newt and put it into play tapped. Cauldron is your only sacrifice outlet. That's the 2 mana artifact. Pay 1 to sack a creature, gain 4, or pay 1, sack Festering Newt, and basically drain 4 from your opponent, so they lose 4, you gain 4. And then Festering Newt is the 1 mana 1/1 creature in black that when it dies, you can give a creature -1/-1 until end of turn, or if you control Bog Brew Witch, that creature gets -4/-4 until end of turn instead. So they each sort of like get bonuses for having another one in play and sort of like a triple fashion, but Bog Brew Witch finds the other two pieces. And the thing about this that I think is important is, again, like only one person at the table can basically piece these things together. And so you can like grab a Bog Brew Witch fifth and be like, oh, I remember seeing Festering Newt earlier, or oh, those Festering Newts didn't come around, so I probably shouldn't grab a Bog Brew Witch in pack two. But they is a real, real build around for one drafter at the table for sure.
Yeah. Also along that same vein in white and black here in the life gain deck, we've got Angelic Accord. That's 3 and a white for the enchantment that if you gained 4 life at the beginning of your end step, as noted in the punting section, you make a 4/4 flying angel token. And then Sanguine Bond is 3 black-black for an enchantment that says whenever you gain life, your opponent loses that much life. Mm-hmm. So kind of both of those are big payoffs and reasons to move into the black-white life gain deck, I think. And certainly if you see them wheel, I think maybe taking note that black-white life gain maybe should be where you're supposed to be at. And also worth noting that Bubbling Cauldron combos very well with Angelic Accord because it lets you sacrifice a creature to gain life in chunks of 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we've got some rare uncommon dragon payoffs. Dragon Tempest. I've had red-black dragon deck once, and Dragon Tempest was pretty impressive in that deck, and I didn't even have a lot of dragon eggs, which I think is where Dragon Tempest really shines. But Dragon Tempest is 1 and a red for the enchantment that gives all creatures with flying that you control haste when they enter the battlefield, and when you have a dragon enter the battlefield on your side of the table, it deals damage equal to the number of dragon spells or dragon creature types that you control on your side of the battlefield. So if you have 2 dragons on your side and you cast a 3rd dragon, when that 3rd dragon enters the battlefield, you get to deal 3 damage to target creature or player. And that gets overwhelming in a hurry if you can go dragon into dragon into dragon.
Yeah.
So kind of the mentality here is that if you're seeing these cards 4 through 8 pick, it's a sign that that archetype or that synergy type deck based around those payoffs is open, and you should maybe consider trying to pick them up and move in.
Yeah. I think that's a great segue into our number 5, which is how to read signals, and that you need to read signals in this draft format much the same way that we did in Ixalan. So in our beard episode, we really outlined like taking cards in the picks 1 through 3 that leave you open to multiple archetypes. And then in, as you just outlined, picks 4 through 8 are really where you're going to notice, oh, Anointed Deacon is coming here, or, oh, I'm getting a Vine Shaper Mystic or a Kamena Speaker. So here, I think it's a lot easier because there are more archetypes to pivot into, and the commons are so good. As we talked about, rarity downshifting really happened a lot in this format. So you're seeing a lot of powerful cards that maybe were uncommons or rares in previous sets where they were originally printed, but now are at the common level. So you're going to get the benefits of those powerful cards and seeing them a lot more often. I think this analogy that you put in the show notes is really apt and is probably very maybe non-intuitive, but Doorkeeper is like One with the Wind, right? It sort of is its own deck in every color. So if you think about that, Doorkeeper is the blue defender that cares about defenders. So it's going to match up well in a blue-red deck because there are a lot of defender options there. And remember that Doorkeeper in of itself in blue has access to Fog Bank and Mnemonic Wall at common and uncommon. And so in red, you have access to Vent Sentinel and Dragon Egg. In green, you've got access to the Wall of Roots and Overgrown Battlement and Carven Caryatid and Jungle Barrier. And then white, you've got Benevolent Ancestor. And then in black, you don't have any defenders, but what is blue-black trying to do? It's trying to mill your opponent for aggro benefits or for winning benefits. So Doorkeeper is going to go into every color pair and going to be able to carve out a niche as a win condition or an an engine in that deck that it's going
to
be in.
Right. So similarly to how One with the Wind enabled you to have a good aggro deck that was blue X in every color pair, Doorkeeper allows you to have a good control deck, I think, in blue X in every color pair.
Totally agree. And the synergy among commons, I think, is pretty important. You're really, you need to draft a deck. And so you even saw on the round table, I was thinking about like, well, if I, at least in my opinion, which could be wrong, but it's my experience, was that I've found that Seeker of the Way, I generally just want to have that in a white-black deck. And so when I took Blinding Mage over it, I was thinking about how Blinding Mage was pairing up with my previous two picks, Doorkeeper and Kakusho, and how that was going to lead me down a deck in the future. I wasn't just sort of grabbing random best cards out of the pack, but was really thinking about what's the best card in conjunction with what I've already got. What's that deck going to look like at the end of the 45 cards that I pick? So I think that's a really important mindset to have.
Yep. On to number four here, which conveniently enough involves the number four. I just realized that.
Oh, I did that on purpose.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and look at you. Nice. I was like late last night at like 2 a.m. was making these show notes on our bus ride home from New York. And then we were texting about the order. That was smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So four toughness is our magic number in the format. So a lot of times, like formats, when we talk about a magic number, like there's a certain amount of toughness that creatures have, like that enables them to block well. Or if your creature has like a certain amount of attack power, it'll be able to attack through creatures that have a lot of this amount of toughness. So a lot of the defender cards have four toughness. So pretty important to have a way, if you're an aggro deck, to punch through these defenders, because they're very good and they all go in decks that are very good. So you've got to have a plan for how you're going to get through these four toughness blockers. And I think it isn't removal in this set, because there's a lot of removal spells that typically would be very good that only do three damage. So notably Draconic Roar, one in a red at instant speed, deal three damage to target creature. And then if you control a dragon, it does three damage to that creature's controller. And Lightning Helix, the white, red, gold card that does three damage to target creature player and you gain three life. I think both of those are a little worse than we initially thought, because they don't do four damage, and four is like the amount of toughness that a lot of creatures have. So they don't really help you punch through those walls. So rather than do that, I think a lot of the cantripping combat tricks are a good way to do this. So for example, some ways that you can punch through Seeker of the Way plus Guided Strike. That's one of the ways that one of the reasons I like Seeker of the Way so much. When you Guided Strike your Seeker of the Way, it gives it four power. So you gaining four life, killing their wall, and drawing a card after casting Guided Strike, which is one and a white, I think, or is it a single white?
One and a white.
One and a white, right? For +1/+1, first strike to your creature and you draw a card. That's a pretty huge swing. Bone Splitter. If I'm playing the defender deck and my opponent plays a Bone Splitter on their side of the battlefield, I am pretty bummed out, because I know every single one of their cards is going to be a threat that I'm going to have to deal with. Because they're going to be able to keep re-equipping Bone Splitter and attacking into my defenders. So Bone Splitter is the one mana indestructible equipment that has an equip cost of 2, and equipped creature gets +2/+0. So that really helps get your little aggro dorks punched through the four toughness walls.
I was trying to let you save yourself and not call it Bone Splitter every time, but it is Darksteel Axe.
Oh, it's not Bone Splitter?
No, it's Darksteel Axe.
Doesn't Bone Splitter do the same thing?
It's not indestructible, and it's one mana cheaper to equip.
Oh, no.
But it's fine. I think it's hilarious that you just call it Bone Splitter each time. You just like got stuck in Meriden land.
Yeah, I don't even know that I knew that those were two different cards.
Amazing.
All right. Names. Card names are overrated. The effect is what's important. Battle Rattle Shaman. That's three and a red for the 2/2 Goblin Shaman, I believe. At the beginning of combat on your turn, you can give target creature +2/+0. So similar to Darksteel Axe. Not Bone Splitter.
Yeah.
Turns all your creatures into threats that must be dealt with by the player that's playing cards with four toughness and hoping to block with them. Infantry Veteran in multiples, especially, that's the single white mana for the 1/1 that can tap to give target attacking creature +1/+1. Helps things punch through. Kiln Fiend naturally gets +3/+0 when you cast an instant or sorcery spell. So it's attacking as a 4/2 then with your first instant or sorcery. So they can't block it unless they've got Event Sentinel over there if they're on the defender deck. And I think Trumpet Blast, not great, but is another way in a pinch that you can punch through some walls.
There's a better version of that, right? What's the white one?
Oh, yeah.
Great Teacher's Decree?
Yes. The three and a white for the rebound, +2, all creatures you control get +2/+1, and then it's got rebound. So it happens twice. That's certainly a much better way to do it than Trumpet Blast. When I made this list, I was just looking at common ways. I think that's why I left it off.
There is, for some reason, fireworks happening, and it is registering as sound effect on my thing. So let's just wait a second. Sorry.
Yeehaw, Pittsburgh.
Yeehaw, Pittsburgh. What that? I mean, did someone win a sports? Maybe someone won a sports.
Oh, I bet that's it. The Steelers are playing the Steelers are playing the Packers tonight.
But it's 8:30. Do they already play?
Yeah. No, it's... Oh, my God. It's Sunday Night Football.
When does that happen?
At 8:30.
Oh, so they start... They fired up... This is the start of the game.
Yeah, it's the start of the game. They must be getting Pittsburgh hyped.
Wow, Pittsburgh hyped. Don't laugh at me about Sunday Night Football. What a jerk.
You live in Pittsburgh and you don't know... Oh, my Lord. That
no, I don't know anything about sports.
Oh, that's great.
I do know what Darksteel Axe is, though.
You do. You got the important things down.
All right, next up, we've got, I think, a really good top three lined up here. And I think number three is the biggest surprise, and that is that you can pick mana rocks less high than you are. So there's a lot of them. You can get them later. So as we outlined in our crash course, there's four common mana rocks. So that's that are two drops that either some tap for a color that's like Star Compass, but most of them are adding generic mana. But then there's also a bunch at uncommon. So you've got... oh gosh, I'm not going to know any of these names, but there's the 3-mana one that can turn into a dragon.
Kolaghan's Monument.
Kolaghan's Monument, thank you, Darksteel Axe. So there's Kolaghan's Monument. There's Thran Dynamo, that's the 4-mana one that taps for 3 generic mana. There's Palladium Mirror, that's the 3-mana 2-2 that taps for 2 generic mana. There's even the...
Pristine Talisman.
Oh, Pristine Talisman, of course. And then there's also the thing at rare, that the 3-mana one that taps for a generic mana, but also if it's in your opener hand and you want a mulligan.
Oh,
you
can... Serum powder.
Yeah, there it is. So there's just so many colorless ways to ramp that you don't need to take them as high as you think. And one of the reasons is in our next bit that we'll get to, so I won't spoil that. But the other thing is that most decks don't want them, because most decks that want to be ramping are probably already green anyway. So you've already got access to all the walls that we talked about, Wall of Roots and Overgrown Battlements. You've got access to Search for Tomorrow, which is that rampant growth effect with Suspend. And you've got access to a bunch of bounce lands that are going to be allowing you to add more mana to your deck and to your board, not in a sort of ramping sense, but at least in a card advantage sense. They're also just like not really synergistic cards. I mean, we've talked about how these decks are working together and how like Doorkeeper is going to fit into different decks in different ways, and how synergy is really important among commons in this set. And I don't really know how these mana rocks fit into all that. There's not really a lot of colorless ramp payoffs for you, right? There's no Eldrazi floating around or like Sundering Titans like there are in Cube. So it's tough to figure out a lot of places to dump mana. Now, there are mana sinks for sure, but a lot of those have color requirements. So there is a one bonus we can think of for sure, which is that they combo well with Skywise Teachings. That's the enchantment that makes 2/2 flyers when you have a... There's the sports fireworks again. You just fire it off. Sports. So Skywise Teachings lets you get a 2/2 flyer when you cast a non-creature spell if you pay one and a blue. So that lets you turn your mana rocks into at least 2/2 flyers late in the game when you've got mana floating around. And they also allow you to dump more mana into that, because that is a mana sink and a place you need extra 2 mana floating around if you want to get the full value to make the 2/2 flyers. But most of the time, I find that there are better things in the pack to pick over these cards, and there are better things in my 45 cards when I'm building my deck than these, and they often are sitting on the sidelines or not at all in my pile. I don't know what your experience has been.
Yeah, I found mana rocks. The only deck I really find that I want mana rocks in that I haven't had yet, but I like can conceptualize or theorycraft it, is like maybe like a blue based control deck that's got like more of a traditional cube type control deck where you've got like several amass the components to draw cards, and like you've opened the good rare finishers, like maybe you've got a Consecrated Sphinx or the Sphinx of, what's it called, Uthun or something like
Sphinx
that?
Yeah, Sphinx of Uthun.
That lets you factor fiction. Like, so if you're getting lots of these rare payoffs and your deck looks more like an actual cube deck, I think that's probably where those mana rocks shine. But even then, I don't think you need to pick them highly, because most decks, like you outlined, just don't really want them. Like the green wall-based ways to ramp are just so much better.
For sure.
All right, so moving on to number two on the list, you need to be taking lands higher than you probably are, especially the Kiru lands. The reason is, and we kind of went over this in the last episode at the end, the Kiru lands are a built-in 2-for-1 at the cost of a tapped land entering the battlefield. So with one card, you essentially get 2 land drops when you bounce your land, and then so like a land plus a carrier land is 3 land drops. You go turn 1 land, turn 2 carrier land, return your land, and then turn 3 you've got the land that you return to play as your third land drop. They help you mulligan better because a 6 card hand with a carrier land is essentially a 7 card hand. So if you've got 1 land plus a carrier land, again, you've got 3 land drops guaranteed in that 6 card hand. So it's essentially a 7 card hand. They help you hit land drops in decks that are super mana hungry. So I've found them to be very important in the Doorkeeper Vent Sentinel decks. Those decks really want a lot of mana, but they don't want to spend card slots like the mana rocks to help you get that mana. So having the, you know, 3 or 4 carrier lands to help you get to 6, 7, 8 lands is really good to start activating those Doorkeeper and Vent Sentinels. They fix you really well, so you should be picking them maybe even if they don't match up with any of the cards you've taken so far. Like, we saw you audibled in your in our round table to green in pack 2 not having taken like any green cards, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they offer you so much flexibility and power throughout the course of a draft, and certainly even if they're only one of your colors, you're going to play them, and you should take them, and they might help you splash off the second color. Maybe you're red-blue, and you take the blue-green one, and then you get past a Simic Sky Swallower. Boom, you've got a way to splash that Simic Sky Swallower, and it's a card you're going to want to put in your deck. So there's a lot of overlapping synergy in the set, and a lot of those bomb rares that you're going to want to splash, and they definitely help out with that. And then I think you kind of pegged this one. You want to talk about Horizon Canopy for a little bit?
Yeah, so Horizon Canopy is the land that you tap and pay a life to add one white or green to your mana pool, and then you can pay one, tap, sacrifice it to draw a card. So it's like a Mind Stone half of that half of Mind Stone on the card. And in non-Phantom Cues, I imagine this isn't a problem because the card is the most expensive card in the set, so you're probably just taking it for value. But in the Phantom Cues, I see this card go very late when I am certain that it has passed by either a white drafter or a green drafter, and they should be taking it there. I mean,
right. The reason it's so expensive is because it's really, really good.
Right. And just thinking about having access to a card, and yes, there's a bit of a downside. You're going to be paying probably 3, depending on how early you play this, you're going to be spending some amount of life on it to add mana. But the value of having a land that can cash in for a card is so, so high. I mean, just think about just back in Hour of Devastation, having the cycling lands at common and how powerful those were to be able to turn late land draws into new, fresh cards off the top of your library. Horizon Canopy gives you that opportunity. And I really think you just need to be grabbing that card basically over everything except bombs if you're in either green or white.
Yep, I could not agree more. I think Evolving Wilds is also another high pick because a lot of times, you know, if you're wanting to splash a card, we talked about in our last episode that you want 3 sources for one card. So let's say you maybe got 2 carry lands. If you've got an Evolving Wilds, then all of a sudden you can splash a card for free without taking up like land slots of your main colors. So you can still have a great mana base and get a splash a card for free a lot of times if you've got 1 or 2 Evolving Wilds. And the Evolving Wilds work well in concert with the carrier lands because they let you play a lower land count and really take advantage of the fact that the carrier lands are a 2-for-1 as far as hitting your land drops goes.
Wait, how does that work with Evolving? Because Evolving Wilds can't find the bounce lands, can they?
No, but it thins your deck out, so you're less likely to draw. I mean, I guess it's a minimal thing, but yeah. It lets you, like, I feel a lot more comfortable playing like 16 lands and 2 copies of Evolving Wilds, for example.
For sure.
Like with the carrier lands than I would in a format without carrier lands. Like, I would be really hesitant if I had 2 Evolving Wilds to play 16 lands, because if you have an Evolving Wilds in your opener, like with just 2 lands or something.
Taking 2 lands out of your deck.
Your basically. Deck, and then like it's a lot harder to hit your third land drop, I think.
Yeah, for
that's
sure.
All no, I was
that,
saying.
That makes sense.
Just a very small percentage.
But a percentage that's worth thinking about. I mean, I think just all the lands, the more that you can draft cards that you're playing in your deck, the more value you're going to have. This is, again, a takeaway you get from playing Cube a lot, that taking the fetch lands and the dual lands in Cube are really high picks because they open you up to a lot of different avenues. And I think the same thing applies here with the Bounce Lands, Horizon Canopy, and Evolving Wilds, for sure. All right, you ready for number one, Ben?
Take us home.
All right, guys. Surprise, surprise. In Magic, blue is great. And in this format especially, it's great because it is both flexible and powerful. So the first point I want to talk about here is something that you sort of highlighted in our show notes, that blue's commons are super deep. Now, you sort of went through and just made lists of the commons you're excited to see out of each color, right?
Yeah.
And what do those lists look like in terms of like maybe numbers or like what cards does blue have that pop out at you?
So blue, first of all, blue has more cards than any other list. So blue has 13 commons that I think are good in at least one deck in the format. And the highest number any other color got to was 9. So white and red both had 9 commons. And then black, I did not realize how bad black's commons were until I went through and made this list. There are only 5 black commons I'm excited about indexed in the format.
And you've even got Rakdos Drake there, which I'm not generally happy
to see. I was struggling to find, like, at least it's got flying. I don't know. I was struggling to find cards to give to black. And green, I only ended up with 6 of them. So just to quickly run through the list of blue commons that are good here. Amass the Components, Claustrophobia is a removal spell, Dissolve, a counterspell, Doorkeeper, the linchpin of all these defender decks, Elusive Spellfist is 1 and a blue for a 1/3 that whenever you cast a non-creature spell, it gets +1/+1 unblockable until end of turn. That's an all-star in the blue-red aggro spells deck. Jace's Phantasm, that's the 1/1 that can grow into a 5/5 in the blue-black mill deck. Jessian Thief, 2 and a blue for the 1/3. Whenever it hits your opponent, you draw a card, and it's got a prowess trigger of +1/+1. Just like a very good, efficient creature in blue. Mana Leak, another counter spell at 2 mana. Mnemonic Wall, 4 and a blue for an 0/4 that lets you rebuy instant or sorcery spells. There's tons of super powerful instants and sorceries to rebuy with your Mnemonic Walls. It's a defender, goes along well in the defender deck. Repeal, just like in cube, a very powerful instant. Blue X, return target permanent with converted mana cost X to their owner's hand, and you draw a card. It cantrips itself. River Wheel Aerialist is a fine finisher. If you don't get any of the rare flying finishers, that's 5 and a blue for a 4/5 flyer with a prowess trigger. Shriekgeist, that's kind of another key engine card in that blue-black mill deck. And Thought Scour, another key engine card in that blue-black mill deck. There's a lot of good playable commons in blue that go into very specific decks that are some of the best decks in the format.
Yeah, I totally agree. So Doorkeeper is a card we've talked about as the key card for blue. It's a linchpin. It fits into every color pair for blue because every color but black has the defenders in them, and blue-black is trying to mill. Amass the Components and Mnemonic Wall are also great. They fit into many control archetypes, so you've got really like powerful engines for those decks. I think every color pair with blue is a really strong deck and gives you a lot of flexibility about what that deck is. Like, maybe I haven't had success with it, but I think there is a world where blue-white tempo is good and blue-white control is good. I think blue-black mill aggro is good and blue-black mill control is good. I think there's a blue-green defender deck. There's also a blue-green ramp deck. There's a blue-red aggro spells deck, and there's a blue-red walls deck. Like, blue has just so much flexibility in this format among all the color pairs that I think when you're hedging maybe between colors, that getting into blue is probably a better choice than not a lot of the time, especially because of how flexible it's going to be when it leads you probably the most open than any color is going to lead you.
Yeah. I think we just want to run down like the decks, at least as far as, and you feel free to disagree, but I kind of grouped decks here into different tiers about like what I've been having the most success with and what's been beating me, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of have tier one as the blue-black mill deck, blue-red aggro spells, blue X control, so blue in any other color as a control deck, and then the various flavors of Vent Sentinel / Doorkeeper Defender decks, and black-white Life Gain. I know Kenji thinks black-white Life Gain is the best deck in the format.
Yeah, I think it's really strong.
Yeah, it's very good when it comes together. Tier 2, I have green-black counters, red-white aggro, blue-green ramp, and blue-white prowess aggro. And then in tier 3, white-green counters, red-black dragons, and like the red-green X spells. Although that red-green doesn't even really feel like it's an X spell deck to me. It just kind of feels bad.
Red-green is like, I mean, I think you can have a red-green Event Sentinel wall deck for sure.
Yeah, but I think that's tier 1 then. That's like, tier I think one. You're yeah, in the that's like just the Event Sentinel plan. I don't think
the whatever Roisin Meanderer deck I don't think really exists.
Right, I agree.
No, I think I agree with that. I think I would probably like I'm more down on red white aggro and probably higher on red black dragons. Like, I think when that deck comes together, it's probably tier 2, but I think I'm mostly in agreement with that. Yeah, I mean, just blue is king. Surprise, surprise.
It really is so good in this format.
All right, I think that is a good place to stop. I've got some serious sports ball to go watch, so probably need to wrap this episode up.
Don't want to miss that Steelers game. Okay. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen. And I think, I haven't talked to him yet because I have not been on the internet because I've been in New York, but I think he got some sweet new patches for the program he uses to mix things. Like, I think he was waiting for a Black Friday deal to buy like a bunch of sweet new sounds for GarageBand.
Oh, snap. That's
awesome. So his music should be better than ever before now.
Hot dog. As a reminder, we still have the XLN treasure hunt going on, though we have unlocked all the treasures. You can still be eligible to be entered into the giveaway for a draft set of Ixalan. So to do that, you need to get a screenshot of you unlocking a treasure hunt on Magic Online, send it to us on Twitter or on our email, and if you unlock 5 of them, you are eligible for that giveaway.
Yeah, we've also set an end date for the treasure hunt. December 20th is going to be the cutoff to submit things for the treasure hunt. Also, conveniently, is the day when Vintage Cube comes out.
Ooh, baby. So excited for Vintage Cube. If people want to get in touch with us individually, you can find us on Twitch. I'm at twitch.tv/LordTupperware. Ben is at twitch.tv/MrMetronome. Please come spam our chats. Give us a follow. Give us a subscription. All that is good stuff. On Twitter, you can find us at those same handles, Lord Tupperware and Mr. Metronome. You can also check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/LordTupperware.
If you've got any feedback about the show or questions, feel free to shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.